Come on.
Welcome to Positively Psychic. Positively Psychic. 2 hours of fascinating interviews and call-ins with your host, the Positively Psychic medium, Mark Christopher Nelson. Positively Psychic. During the show, Mark will invite you to call in to speak with him and his guests. Call in for a free reading and contact your guides, guardian angels, friends, and loved ones on the other side. Positively Psychic. Join the online chat to share thoughts and experiences with like-minded souls at www.para-x.com. Positively Psychic. Listen in now as the Positively Psychic medium, Mark Christopher Nelson, interviews leading experts in the paranormal field, takes your calls, and answers your questions on Positively Psychic.
Hello, welcome to Positively Psychic. I'm your psychic medium host, Mark Christopher Nelson, and tonight I am flying solo. My lovely wife, psychic spouse, is under the weather, so hopefully you won't get too tired of hearing my voice. But to make up for it, I have brought one of the nicest radio voices I have heard in some time. I don't know if it's the southern thing or it could be quite a few things. But that voice happens to be attached to a wonderful author. She's written a number of books on some really fascinating haunted locations. So please give a Positively Psychic welcome to Beth Brown.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Beth.
Up to that introduction.
Oh, of course you are. I'll whip you into a frenzy, too. It'll be great. You won't be able to sleep for hours, or at least, how about at least the end of the show? That would be nice.
Oh, no problem. Got that.
Well, Beth, I have in my hands, my hot little hands, a copy of your book, Haunted Plantations of Virginia. And I have to tell you, I've gone through it, and both Barbara and I have been itching to make a trip to the South and to investigate some of these places. And in going through the book, it's got a lot of great stories, and it's got some beautiful photographs, and compliments to you on the writing. You've done a masterful job in weaving together stories about runaway slaves and soldiers and families, and there's as much drama in these places as anything that Shakespeare could have whipped up in all of those castles across Europe.
Absolutely. We love our drama in the South. I think that's what keeps everything here so vivid and makes the history really still feel like part of the present, is because we still gossip about it like it just happened weeks ago.
Well, your book is filled with some, again, some terrific stories. I mean, I'm not even sure where to begin, but I wanted to let everybody know that it's available through Schiffer Publishing, and hopefully I'll be coming out with a book for them sometime, and I think it releases in 12, which will mean that I will have finished it this year, and that's what I'm shooting for. But back to you. So, you know, I'm looking just to give everybody an idea of it, and again, at the title is Haunted Plantations of Virginia. When you go through it, these homes are massive. They're sprawling. They do have that same kind of a weather-worn look that you'd think only existed in Europe. And there's so many great stories, and we've got Civil War, the Civil War that occurred and are in and around many of these homes. You've got small places. You've got places out in more rural places, locations. But one of the first places you get to is Rosewell.
And yes. That was actually my favorite spot for the entire research phase of the book.
Well, beautiful. I mean, beautiful location. And so can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to that? What made it your favorite?
Well, since you have a copy of the book there, you can probably see right away what makes it so intriguing and so different from all of the other sites. Rosewell is actually a ruin now. The house burned down in the early 20th century, so what's left is just some very well-preserved brickwork, and it's almost surreal to drive up to it and see fireplaces suspended at second and third floor heights. It almost looks like a castle standing there in ruin, something that you would see in the UK or mainland Europe that's just been ravaged. But here you have this piece of history standing alone in the middle of this rural area. People go just to visit it because of its history and its importance to Virginia, that being because it was built by a member of one of Virginia's founding families. And that's something that'll come up quite often during this talk tonight, I'm sure. We have about a dozen first families, and those really are responsible for a lot of the major settlements here in the state. The Page family were the ones that built Rosewell. And the really sad story that goes with it is Man Page, the patriarch of the family, once the estate was finished, he did not live to see his furniture or his belongings moved in. He died. His first stay in the house was as a corpse on display for his friends and family to come visit.
Ah, well, that's not exactly what I would call a housewarming.
No, exactly. And that really started the gossip that the site was cursed, that maybe his family was never intended to move there. It had been old Indian land, and of course there was a lot of struggle between the English settlers and natives here. And that really went on for well over 150 years. Pretty much by the time the Civil War rolled around, the fighting between the natives and the settlers had calmed down, so we haven't seen a lot of rest here. But oddly enough, Man Page, even though this was his intended to be his home, and he moved into it dead, if you want to say it like that, he's not one of the spirits that sought to haunt there.
That's peculiar. I mean, but you know, with so many hundreds of years of history, I guess it's maybe his mission was to build it, and maybe he died satisfied knowing that.
Maybe. We can only speculate, I guess.
Well, I can call him if you'd like.
Go for it.
Yeah, well, it would be fun if I could. But
well, no,
you've
the
got slaves are there. Well, how many I see that there's a story about a slave there, but I'm sure it's one of many. Who do you think is inhabiting Rosewell?
The story about slaves singing these hymns, it's probably the most common thing that's reported in that area. And it being sort of isolated, there's water around it. It's really built out on a marsh. There's very little in the way of development out there, even though it's not really very far from Norfolk and other big military bases, major cities, that kind of thing. But just hearing singing, obviously coming from a group, sort of like a choir type of voice, from the woods, where you can tell there's no one there, especially no one in numbers like that, is very unsettling, very memorable, and the stories go back generations. The slave quarters were very close to the house, so it's in an area that's still very well preserved now, and people that still go to visit the ruins are hearing these things that have never heard the legend before. So that, to me, rings that there's probably some root of truth in that.
Well, so, you know, one thing in investigating a set of ruins, and it's interesting, you've got this beautiful photo in the book of what the home looked like in 1916, and back then it was a three-story structure with a raised basement is what it looks like.
Right. It had, I think they're called dry basement. It's something that has these arches, almost like catacombs. It's not like a basement you think of now where you go in and you can see floor joists and that sort of thing. The basement was really built as a structure of its own, then with a house over top of it. But no, the one chamber of that cellar is still standing. The rest is just sort of crumbling, piles of sand all around, some steel I-beams holding it all together.
Well, that's what makes it like you're seeing a castle. I'm looking at this one, and you know, I would think it'd be tempting and probably a little bit suicidal to want to climb up on some of these things.
Oh no, they would stop you pretty quickly. It's very well protected. People are constantly working on the preservation, replacing the mortar and that kind of thing. But you're free to walk around inside of the ruin as long as you don't climb onto anything. And they have just mounds of sand. You can get so high on some of these mounds of sand that you're almost at the height of the second story.
Wow.
It makes for some good photo opportunity.
Well, let's say you wanted to, in doing your investigation, I mean, is it a place that you're permitted to go late at night, or how does it work for you?
There is a state archaeology lab that works on site, and this is a structure separate from the ruins at Rosewell. And you could go ahead and contact the folks that are in charge there, see about having nighttime permission. Unfortunately, they were going through a lot of rehab and trying to get some state funding for the project when I approached them, so I had to go in the daytime and the off season when it was very light traffic, which is the summertime here. No one else wanted to endure the 100-degree heat and humidity but me. And daytime investigating there can be as lucrative and fruitful, I would think, as anything you could do at night. Maybe a little better because you have the advantage of being able to see where you're going and not falling into sinkholes.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially in a place like that. Heck, we were just at the Wolf Manor, and it gets so dark in there, and other places, of course. But so I walked into the wall during one point. It doesn't give very much. That place is very solid. But when you're there, I mean, are you able? What are some of the phenomena that people have found or seen? Are they capturing EVPs? Or are they seeing spirit? I mean, I can only imagine some of the visuals people are seeing.
From what I've heard, only one person or one group has come away with an EVP of that singing sound that we were talking about. And that was, I want to say it was the fall of 2009. But one of the most common visual phenomena that people talk about there is the Lady in Red. They always have a really cool, catchy name like that, don't they? Mm-hmm. No one's really sure who she is, but the people that see her say that she's in some sort of Edwardian-style dress, really dark red in color, and she comes down the front stairs, which are really the only remaining stairs that you can see there, and she runs off into the woods. Who she was, what her purpose is, what she's running to or from, nobody seems to be able to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
Have you had a chance to work with any mediums or in that? Anyone that might be able to tell you something?
No, but there's some peculiar history I found out about after the book was published in regards to that. Because it's near the coast, and you may already be aware of this, maybe some other people aren't, the Edgar Cayce Institute is in Virginia Beach, which is not very far from this and a few others that are included. I did read some case reports where Edgar Cayce and a few other investigators that he worked with went out to the Rosewell site to see what they could find. I'm not sure what their investigations turned up, but I know he visited more than once. So that, to me, sounds like there was some interest.
Well, that and as it turns out in your book, that is not the only haunted location featured in your book that is in Virginia Beach. The Adam Thorogood home. Again, you know, I have to tell you that I love seeing the architecture. It's kind of breathtaking. And for you to be able to wander through here, I mean, I love history. I mean, for that reason, I mean, we do have some here in Southern California, but it's interesting. Some of it is fascinating. The missions are beautiful and they're full of life, all kinds of it, including spirit life. But I am drawn to some of the older establishments in these older places in the East Coast. And you say, in your book, you say it's kind of tucked away in a little kind of a residential neighborhood, this beautiful old gem. Can you tell us a little bit how did you find, in doing your research for the book, and by the way, you've done a lot. I mean, you give a wonderful history of Virginia and, you know, some of the other background or the whole region, really. A nice overview. How did you find out about this place? And especially, it's one thing to find Rosewell out in the middle, and it's beckoning. But how did you find this place?
There were really a combination of things that led me to most of these sites in the book. One was a website I started many years ago called Virginia's Most Haunted. Mm-hmm. And that had a forum where people could come and submit any stories or legends that they knew, any firsthand encounters that they'd had themselves. And this was back before I had written the Haunted Battlefields book. And I started noticing that many of these reports were coming from the same places. Mm-hmm. And the eyewitness encounters had lots of similarities. So just, I didn't have to get really all CSI about it.
They were like, hey, come over here. Wait until
right.
you see this one.
It was pretty obvious. You know, you start listing these things into a spreadsheet and you see, you know, one spot pops up 10 out of every 100. Something is going on. Either just rumors are running rampant or something is truly going on there that's catching people's attention. That's how I found out about the Adam Thurgood House, was from someone who had been filming for a public access show here in Virginia looking for haunted locations. He happens to be in Virginia Beach, and he said, hey, my kid went on a field trip a few years ago to this place. And after hearing about some of the stories the kids came back with, excuse me, he went and researched further and found out that these stories of actual visual apparitions, poltergeist activity, you name it, this house has it. They go back hundreds of years. The house is actually one of the oldest standing plantation homes in Virginia. It goes back to the early 1600s.
Wow. And it looks very well preserved, I have to tell you.
That's another good thing about living in the South. We don't let our history slip away. I think that folks here in Virginia especially struggled so hard to keep what they had, mm-hmm. that even after the state was war ravaged, what little bit could be preserved was just treated like trophy. If you can imagine, we even have, you know, this is where Robert E. Lee hitched his horse when he stopped here for drink of water, that kind of thing. It's people here have seen how quickly it can all slip away, so they work very hard to preserve what's left.
Well, that's a really wonderful observation. A wonderful. I have to tell you, one of the spookiest things. I mean, I've had a chance to glance. I haven't read all of the book, but I'm going to. By the way, don't go there now, Beth will explain why, but plan a little later in the year, and you will be able to see some pretty amazing places. But this one story in the Adam in the house about of all things, a tour getting kind of somewhat terrorized by four globes that hurricane globes yes. that suddenly do something different. Can you tell people a little bit about this story?
I love this story because, like you said, it was a tour group in there. It wasn't just one person closing up for the day or something like that. It always seems to be the best things are reported when there's only one person as a witness. Well, this poor woman had an entire group of adults in for a Christmas tour. The house was all decorated. And when we're talking about this house, I'm sure a lot of people have this vision in their heads of this huge estate. The Adam Thurgood House is actually only three rooms. There are two rooms on the first floor, and the second floor, it's more like a Cape Cod-style house. The second floor is one large room. There's not a whole lot of places for people to move around, hide, anything like that. So foul play was not even in the question with this one. Mm-hmm. They're standing all together in one room as the candle fixtures that are on the walls there, the glass that surrounds the candle, on each of the four fixtures, raised above the flame, came out towards the center of the room and dropped on the floor altogether.
Wow, I think that even like some of the characters from Harry Potter would be hard-pressed to recreate that, you know?
I think so.
Wow, I mean, that does really... Now, it makes you wonder, okay, Spirit is not pleased with a lot of people trooping through the house, or it was a Friday, Spirit had had enough.
That's the strange thing about that one site. They seem to have interactive entities, the poltergeist activity, and a lot of the sort of looping activity where people pace around. There's a man that's seen in the house quite often, but he does not ever interact with anyone.
Well, maybe he is. Is that Argold Thurgood?
Yes, and say that three times fast.
I got a cramp in my tongue. I'm going to have to let you talk and let it...
No, I mean, we're talking just a few years after the first settlers at Jamestown, so I give him the benefit of the era as to blame for his name.
Argol. No. I'm glad that, you know, Barbara and I never even got close to considering that. We had one name for a boy. Our daughter turned out to be a girl, but Argol was... It feels like our goal is to become the best ghost hunter. No, that's a little different.
It's A-R-G-O-L too, right?
Yeah, it's got a double L.
That fell through the cracks.
Well, and other than this, when you're talking poltergeist, though, I always associate it with having a lot of children spirits or child energy. And I wouldn't think that this place has either very much, but maybe were you able to maybe get some idea as to where this might have come from?
This site is not inhabited. It's open now as a museum, and it's preserved by the city of Virginia Beach. the activity just seems to be focused in the house, no one around in the neighborhood, and a lot of the houses surrounding it are built on what was the Thurgood property. There are no stories like this coming from any of the other homes. It is on the edge of the Lynnhaven River, where the river meets the Atlantic Ocean. It's very, very close to the coast, and how this little house has survived hurricane after hurricane, I will not understand. Maybe it has some sort of paranormal protection plan. But the source of the paranormal activity is still unknown. There's been no great tragedy in the house, no really even harsh family conflict that you would think would leave such an emotional imprint. Historians really just say it was a nice family home. Well, it was passed along generation to generation, and nothing strange reported until, I want to say it was around the 1870s. The first stories go back that far.
Well, you know what it might be? It might be the fact that you've got all of the Native Americans. Maybe they're the ones, it's their spirits that are causing some of the trouble.
And that's entirely possible. That was an area of really heightened conflict. Obviously, the riverbanks and the marsh areas here were a favorite habitat of all the natives because that's where things are plentiful. Of course, that's also where the English settlers wanted to make their farms and their sprawling manors and such. So you could be onto something. See, I think you have a knack for this Virginia historical research.
Well, we've run into, doing our own history out here. We actually, I've been doing some investigating with some friends from Pacific Coast recently, and they took me to a home that it's a townhome. So, but the thing that makes it interesting is that it's supposed to be an area where Native Americans, local tribe called the Chumash, had burial grounds. Now, I know not every place in America that is haunted is has an Indian burial ground history. Now, what I've been told is that I do know that the Chumash, who are quite plentiful out here, did populate this area, and you could see why. It's you know, they're going to choose a place that's not so hot, doesn't get so hot, doesn't get so cool. You know, it's and so funny, some of the same lines where people like to live, the Native Americans chose to live there as well, and that's probably like, say, in your book, say where Bacon's castle may have run into some trouble. I love to say, okay, there really is a castle in your book.
So. Bacon's castle has probably the most inappropriate name of any of the sites here in Virginia. If you guys remember in history class learning about Bacon's rebellion. I can give you the 30-second recap.
Sure.
The English government wanted to be very tolerant of the natives at this point in history because they had been massacred over and over and over. So their best bet was to kind of ease back a little, don't push the development too quickly. Well, Nathaniel Bacon felt opposite was true. He thought they had the firepower, the manpower, and the motivation. They should just go in and take all of the land, all of the prime real estate that these natives were living on. So he rebelled against the English government. Bacon's castle was actually the home of a man named Arthur Allen. Poor Arthur got bounced from his house when the rebellion swept through and supporters of Nathaniel Bacon took over and basically made it a fort. It was truly a castle. They fortified the walls. They were armed. They stayed up in the top floor windows, would shoot anyone that got near. And for some reason, the site's most famous paranormal tale is not of a person, but of some strange glowing fireball is what it's called. Sort of just a floating ball of light that comes from a cemetery in the woods near the house, circles the home, and then either goes down a chimney. That's what part of the encounters tell. Some people say it just hovers near the house and then it slips away back into the woods really quickly.
Some of the structures are just, you know, when you look around this place, I mean, you've got like these three chimneys. By the way, if you're a history buff too, Beth's got some really interesting photographs. This building is kind of unusual looking. I mean, it's a fortress, but it's got these triple chimneys set up and all brick but round walls. And So
right. And I, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's Jacobian architecture, if there are any architects out there that could inform me. But the brickwork on this is fantastic. And the home is so old and so well kept that you can go there. You can still see mini balls from the Civil War. You can still see musket balls from the Revolution. I've heard that they found lots of cannonballs on the property. There are even archaeological digs that have gone on just a short distance up the bank of the James River where Bacon's Castle sits. And I mean a short distance, like less than a quarter of a mile away, where they have found native artifacts that go back over 10,000 years. So wow. There's no doubt in my mind that that's not confined to just that area of the archaeological dig. I'm sure it's the entirety of that stretch of the riverbank.
Well, how wonderful of Mr. Bacon, Nathaniel Bacon, I guess it was, to decide that, oh, they've only been there 10,000 years. We like it. We would like to have it. And we have guns. They have only those silly bows and arrows. Well, I can't imagine that Bacon's rebellion turned out all that well for Nathaniel Bacon. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, Nathaniel, he died as a result just of illness, not of injury. And the folks that took Arthur Allen's house, they did manage to keep it fortified from September to December. And then once the rebellion fell apart, they moved on.
Well, that makes sense. But,
they didn't have a leader to follow after that, and the whole thing just sort of went to pot. Well, fortunately for the natives, I think.
Oh, yes. Well, it's hard to imagine. Well, history played out, and they eventually moved, but... here's one that you don't hear about is the lady with the white hands.
Oh yes, the house was inhabited. It was just a regular home for quite a while. Then it was opened as a museum where the curator lived on site. Just their family home was in the second floor, and people could come and visit and walk around the first floor. One of the occupants of the home, I want to say it was in the 1980s, the man had an infant son, and the child woke up in the middle of the night. He heard the boy talking and laughing, went in to investigate, and his toddler was asking him where was the lady with the white hands that was tickling him.
Ah.
There have been other run-ins with entities in the home, and they really, again, like the Adam Thurgood house, they run the gamut. You have poltergeist activity there, you have visual apparitions, you have auditory phenomena. One of my favorites is the guide who was standing in a main hall, and this house has that main hall structure with rooms off of either side, said she heard the footfalls of someone running through the house, very clearly heavy feet running. And it was coming towards her. She froze. She was the only one in the house. She just unlocked for the day. As the footfalls came past her, she could even hear the breeze of someone's clothing as they went by. Never saw a thing.
Wow. And if you're by yourself, that kind of thing jumps out like crazy.
That's when you step back outside and you catch your breath and you come in 10 minutes later.
Yes. Just if only to collect yourself.
Well, definitely.
Well, there's so many places. I mean, I don't know that we'll get to all of them. I also wanted to talk, Beth, about, if you don't mind me jumping around a little bit, your Civil War Battlefields book. Can you tell us the title of that book and tell us a little bit about that?
The title is Haunted Battlefields, Virginia's Civil War Ghosts. So that's, in a nutshell, what the book is about there. It's battlefields exclusively Civil War and exclusively here in Virginia. With that book, I really focused on battlefields that run north to south in the state. We have a lot of the war campaigns were very much towards the eastern portion or in the valley, the mountains to the west. But the ones that were of greatest intensity were those around Richmond and Petersburg and Fredericksburg. Any Civil War buff could tell you those three cities are basically in a direct north-south line within 150 miles of one another. And this whole area is just peppered with battlefields. I think at one point I counted there were over 250 just within a 100-mile radius. And that includes everything from, you know, your minor skirmish that maybe lasted an hour that had a couple of hundred men, maybe even just a few dozen men, to enormous battles that, of course, you know, go down in history as some of the heaviest casualties in North America.
Well, Fredericksburg is certainly one of those places. I mean, to walk through there, some like in an evening or maybe on an anniversary of the battle, I mean, I would tend to think you would hear echoes almost. I mean, that kind of thing just doesn't go away that quickly.
No, and Fredericksburg is really, in my opinion, a unique battlefield. It was the first site of urban warfare in North America. It was a city at the point when the war broke out. It was still a city standing when the two armies collided there, with civilians in the midst. And now there's still a city there now. It's built up around the battlefield. Areas of major importance were preserved. Nothing was built there. Of course, it's just sort of like hallowed ground now. A lot of the Civil War battlefields here are treated that way. So you have new houses, old houses, and the battlefields in between. Obviously, these things are under close observation all the time because they're in the middle of a town. People walk around them. People are out in them all the time. And when it's quiet there at night, some really odd things go on. And the folks in Fredericksburg do not let any of that slip by. They do tell each other about it. They talk to people from out of town about it. They're really, I guess, sort of proud that this paranormal activity is there and still a reminder of what happened 150 years ago.
Well, Beth, I mean, all I can think of, I mean, I've been to Gettysburg, and I was really overwhelmed with the sense of energy that seems to hang in the air. I mean, there's so much that is still and remains in Gettysburg, and I imagine that that's the case in Fredericksburg. Can you tell us a story or two about Fredericksburg and some of the things that people have seen there?
My favorite area of the Fredericksburg battles is a place called Marie's Heights. Obviously, geographically, it was a high point, and any army wants to take the highest point for their advantage. Well, at the base of this hill was an old sunken road that had a stone wall to the side. And, you know, this is looking almost identical to the trench warfare that was used in World War I and World War II. This was a trench that was used for civilians all the time, just buggies and carts going through there constantly. Well, when the Confederate Army took up this trench in the sunken road, the Union Army came across the Rappahannock River and tried to charge to the top of Marie's Heights, where all of the Confederate artillery was. Basically, you have one army in a very, very strong defensive position with just waves of attackers trying to come and steal that position, and they're just going down right on top of one another. It was a massacre is really the only thing that you could compare it to. Anybody who's seen the movie Gods and Generals?
Yes, I have.
Was infinitely better than Gettysburg, I must say. We have to pretend that that one wasn't made into a film yet. The scene of the sunken road in Marie's Heights is one where the Irish Brigade, that's the Union force that was coming through and just falling and falling, was one of the most emotional in the whole movie, in my opinion. And you can really pick up on emotions like that when you visit the preserved stretch of that sunken road. People that live in the town, this is only a 2-block stretch of road that's preserved. They walk through there as a shortcut, going wherever it is they need to go. So you imagine yourself, and this is also right in the midst of a downtown college campus.
Well, one of our listeners, Denmother, says that out of the 100,000 people who died in Fredericksburg, there are only 5,000 markers. So
right.
When you walk into town, according to Denmother, and I thank her again, you're walking on the dead. So if there's a trench where this kind of bloodbath took place, tread lightly and say a prayer, I would think.
Definitely. And that's the case at many of the Virginia battlefields. The armies here were in such a hurry to move from point A to point B. And sometimes you had to do it to defend your life, that the dead were left on the battlefield sometimes more than a year before the grave services came back through. And basically at that point, you had only bones. Seldom did you have anything to identify the remains. And that is one of the top theories right now as to why we have so many battlefield haunts. So many people were lost and forgotten.
That, yeah, I mean, certainly that's one thing I know just from my own investigations, that spirit very often wants to let you know, we're here, I'm here, I counted. I was someone, I was a dad, I was a brother, I was a son, and you just can't make me disappear.
Right. And it's working with battlefields, which really was one of the first things that I began intensive study on many, many moons ago. There is, even for people that claim to not be sensitive to things like this, there is an emotion that hits you. Even if you don't know the history of a site, there is just something you can feel in the air. Like walking into a room where someone has had an argument, you know, you walk into some tension. It's like that, only walking in where a tragedy has occurred. You just feel this heavy grief. And I don't think that I've set foot on a battlefield, period, not just in Virginia, where that was not the case.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Well, I'll go. I've been to a Revolutionary War location in New Jersey, the Battle of Monmouth, and that was a terrible battle, but it was small by comparison. I mean, it wasn't small to those unfortunate soldiers fighting on both sides, but the scale of this battle, and the intensity of it is hard to get your head around, especially when we live in a time where, I mean, I don't want to see another one of our soldiers lose his or her life in Afghanistan or Iraq. But the idea that back then we had a different approach. Okay, get that line of 5,000 men, and we're going to march them right into this, you know, death trap.
Right.
And we're going to do it now, and we're going to play a little song, and we're all going to march, and we're all going to be very brave. And those poor men primarily sacrificed their lives, although I'm sure that quite a few civilians, innocents, men, women, and children were probably lost in that kind of fighting as well.
Absolutely. And those spirits do hang around, even though they didn't have the same emotional intensity as the soldiers that were out on these battlefields. They still seem to be lost, or maybe just don't understand what has happened to them. It's the whole concept of the battlefield haunt is a sad one. I've yet to come across anything really positive or uplifting about it, but as a paranormal investigator, it also offers such a base of study. There's so much activity that you'd really just be shooting yourself in the foot to turn it down. So you learn to deal with the emotional side of it and look at it as just more of a case study.
Oh, sure. Well, I know in Gettysburg when we were there, we went to the site of a couple of battles. We were at, went to Little Round Top. We went to, I know this is outside, right outside your state, but I understand the Army of Virginia was involved.
Yes. They had their hands in just about everything.
Yes, they were all over that. They were led by General Lee at that battle. And the devil, I think it's the Devil's Den. I swear I heard like people talking in there and people just audible whispers, loud whispers.
And then that's a very unsettling thing.
Yes, especially when I know there's just some little kid in a T-shirt that says, you know, Disneyland over there, and I know where he is, and I hear all of these other, voices. And then, what was it? We took photos, and I know that some orbs are just bugs, and some orbs are just dust. But when you look at the historic significance of a place and you take a photo and then you see a really exorbitant number of orbs, it makes me think that it is more than just a few bugs flying around, you know, that are accidentally captured. We went to this one, we took a photo, my daughter did. Oh, that's an interesting building. It was a tall, narrow building, and it turns out the guide said it had been used as a field hospital. And they were throwing human limbs out into this front courtyard you know, in enormous piles. I'm sorry, but that's what it was.
That's the way it happened. Yeah, the surgeons had to work quickly to save lives, and you know, once it was cut off, it wasn't needed anymore. It was just cast out.
And what we saw, that they looked almost like strings of pearls, not the occasional orb, but running down the front of this building, hanging on the front of this building. It was almost like a netting filled with orbs. And it was pretty amazing. So Beth, tell me, in terms of like some of the places, the battlefields, did you personally experience some things that you still think about today?
Oh, definitely. the battlefield investigations have been an ongoing thing for me since about 1990. Really, my first, if you want to call it an investigation, it was sort of an accidental investigation, happened at a home that was used as a field hospital after a battle here right outside of Richmond. And I just went there to interview the woman that owned the home. This was back, I was in middle school, 12 years old, I think, and was doing this for a school project. And I took along a tape recorder, recorded the interview. She was telling me about the things that she'd experienced in the house and gave me the history of the home. And at one point in the interview, she's telling me, just like the story that you were telling just a moment ago about Gettysburg, how the second floor had been used as the surgeon's headquarters. And if they had to perform amputations, the limbs went out the back window. And this was in late July here in South Virginia, where it's very hot, very humid. And at that point in the interview, when I was going back and making my notes later, when I was out of the house, never had any idea any of this was coming, I hear a man's voice interject that says, "The stench was awful." And you know, I had read up on the time stream experiments and all of that kind of thing that was going on back in the 50s and 60s. I was well aware of what EVP was at that time. Mm-hmm. Never in my wildest dreams did I think I was going to catch anything like that myself. I thought this was something that people in laboratories far, far away do. Sure. It's people that just go and interview nice little old ladies that live in old houses. But that was my first experience with something battlefield related. And obviously it sort of steered me in a direction that I've stuck with for some time. More recently though, one of the sites that I don't even want to say it impacted me. It shook me. It made me really stop and reassess everything I thought I knew about the paranormal. And that was a battlefield called Cold Harbor, which it's one of the worst battles in Civil War history, just for the casualties, for the conditions, the ferocity of the battle. It's one that General Grant said he wished he'd never ordered. It was that bad. That was the first battlefield that I got permission from the National Park Service to investigate at night. This was back when they really weren't keen on the idea of having people out after dark at all, just because here in Virginia especially, they've had such a bad track record with relic hunters, people that go out with metal detectors at night and damage the earthworks and trample things and really make a mess of stuff. But after lots of sweet talking and paperwork and paperwork and paperwork, the feds agreed to it. We had a team of 10 go out for this investigation, and we were accompanied with a law enforcement ranger from the Park Service. So we were safe. We were on the trails through this battlefield. We did not really expect to have anything happen to us on the few hours that we were out there. We thought we were going out to observe. Maybe we would make some audio recordings and video recordings and see something when we went home. Well, about an hour into the investigation, and we're walking along through the trail in the woods, the ranger's telling us, okay, we're crossing over the stream. This is where the heart of the battle was. This is where the most people fell. I think it was 5,000 men died there in less than 2 hours.
It was atrocious. It was, I mean,
yes.
If you read about this battle, it was just shocking. I mean, Gettysburg took longer, but this was so fast, I think, in terms of a day or so.
Absolutely. The highest number of casualties happened in such a short time, but it was also a site where snipers were in the trees. Men were afraid to go and try and help their injured friends off of the battlefield for fear that they would be shot. They wouldn't even get up to go to the bathroom. It was that bad. You were basically stuck where you were until they called the battle off. But we crossed the stream at the heart of the battlefield, and you could just feel something in the air change. Mm-hmm. It was late September, early October, so it was a nice cool night, and then all of a sudden the temperature just plummets. People started saying, hey, I'm getting weird things in my photos. You know, I'm getting a ton of orbs. What are these red things? It was bizarre, and that, you know, it just started suddenly. It's not like something we were catching in the hour leading up to this. It just happened to coincide with this one spot on the battlefield. Walking along in the single file line, folks are talking about this going on. I was at the rear. I had two people behind me, and just a black shadow right in front of me on the path stepped out in front of me. It looked like it was maybe 2.5-3 feet away when I saw it. And you have to imagine, we're working very, very low light, glow sticks, no flashlights, and night vision goggles. But whatever this was in front of me blocked all of the light from the people ahead of me in the line, and actually made me stop and jump back so fast that the two people behind me piled up on my back, kind of Three Stooges style. We all crammed together there. And it wasn't until later that I learned that many of the joggers through that park that jog in the early, early hours of the morning have reported seeing shadows in that area. Now, had I known I was getting into a situation where there were shadow people on a battlefield, I might have been better prepared for that instance. But that's one that really set my nerves on edge for the rest of the evening.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's one thing. I mean, I've thought about it. You know, I've walked into places where I have seen shadow people, but when you're kind of expecting it, it takes the edge off of you wanting to run and scream like a little boy or girl out of the house. That never really makes a good impression. But
no.
It's never worked for me. But
no, here I am leading the investigation, trying to keep a level head, and, you know, just got a shock. You know, even though it's a very short-term shock, you see this thing, your brain registers it, and then you blink and it's gone. Still, it's a shock nonetheless. We were really not prepared, even after that incident, for the big finale of the evening, which was when this battlefield has this legend that's attributed to it, and that's all I thought it was until this point. This legend goes back until, God, I want to say 1867. So you're talking just a couple of years after the war ended, and really just less than 5 years between the battle and this starting up. It sort of comes out of nowhere. It settles across the battlefield, and every night it's 1 a.m., it's just, it's on a clock. I don't know if it takes into regard daylight savings time or what, but it seems to be 1 a.m. every night. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to take a look around before we go out here. There's got to be some sort of low-lying area that this is just ground fog that's collecting. People are nuts. We have a lot of ground fog in this area. Usually it's only in spring and fall, but hey, you know, people are saying they see it all year. We'll see what happens. I saw nothing on the terrain that would lead me to believe that this was just some sort of low spot. The creek that's really at the heart of the battle, mm-hmm, sort of runs perpendicular to the road. The road is the low spot. You would think that if this fog came out, it would land on the road. Well, we were wrapping up our investigation for the evening, and we were walking back towards the parking lot, maybe a quarter mile away, and just... you felt the temperature drop again, and I think somebody even got readings. It dropped like 15 degrees.
Wow.
And as everybody's going, whoa, something's going on, we all stop. We're in sort of a huddle in the middle of this park road, as just right across us comes this thick fog, maybe only 7 or 8 feet across, snakes across the road, and by the time we registered what it was, you couldn't see someone right next to you. And it was just this sort of enveloping mist. It moved right past where we were, and in less than a minute, it had gone all out and settled onto the low spot in the battlefield. And it sounds hokey, but my first instinct was to see what time it was, and it was 1 a.m.
Oh, my God.
That was the exclamation point on the evening for me.
That's a nice crescendo. That's a pretty big to-do at the end of it all.
Now, and like you said earlier, I hope folks won't go and look at this now, but later after the show, head over to YouTube and you can look up the username Virginia Ghost, V-A Ghosts, and you can see a little mini documentary that we made about Cold Harbor and that investigation that night. We had some great photos of the fog.
That just chills me. That does chill me to the bone. What can I tell you? I mean, that's one hell of a... You know, it just all that is just another unit that's out of maneuver still. That's all.
Maybe. You know, it's one of those things like in New England, they have the legend of the Headless Horseman. Oh, people hear this horse galloping by at the same time every night. And of course, you've heard the story so much, you think, yeah, okay, sure, this is something that adults say to keep their kids and teens away from this place at night or whatever. And then when you really observe it, you have to stop and go back and think, okay, wait a minute, what else have I been told that I just wrote off as legend that might be true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been itching to go see the Headless Horseman up in the Hudson River Valley area. I know that's just a story. That's a good story.
Maybe people giving so much attention to these stories sort of lends to their reality.
Well, I have to tell you, when we were in Virginia, we were in Gettysburg. That's really, I keep going back to that. But we were there on the 4th of July, which is at the anniversary of the battle. And there were literally, I don't know how many, tens of thousands, like at least more than 5,000 people. I just know that everywhere I looked, I saw Civil War reenactors. And in addition, they were their spouses with them. So we saw lots of people in costume or in the historic clothing of the day. And on top of that, there was fireworks. And I had to like double check to see what year is this? What time is this? Where am I? I mean, if that didn't bring out a lot of ghosts that may have responded to seeing all of this, the thinning between dimensions, I don't know what would.
No, absolutely. I like to call the reenactors the decoy ducks.
Oh.
Because it seems to be that whenever they're out and they're camping in period style and they're wearing the period clothing and just sort of performing all of these actions, again, it's so attractive to the spirit energy. And I don't know if it's just because they're there so seldom that it seems maybe they're just noticing this activity more. And just, you know, when they're paying it a quick visit, when they're camping there, they notice a lot of these things. I have heard some of the best firsthand encounters from reenactors that camp overnight in these places. It's tempting to go and sign up, but here in Virginia, that is a full-time job.
Oh, I can only imagine. I mean, I would look twice at the guy or the girl standing next to you and make sure, can I see through you? Do you seem fairly solid?
And, you know, a lot of the reports that park rangers hear, and like I said earlier, we have a lot of joggers that go out to these places because they're nice trails. You know, you have hills and you're not running on pavement. And they go to the park rangers when the rangers come in a little after 7 and say, hey, did you have a reenactment going on this weekend? You know, because I just saw a guy out there in a uniform, but I couldn't find where he came from. You know, things like that.
We actually do have a question.
Themselves.
Well, we have a question for you from the chat room from Ceiling Cat. She's saying, do you consider yourself a skeptic? And how do you explain some of these experiences you had? How do you process these events when you're going through them?
I am a skeptic, but I am not a cynic. I am open to the possibility of the paranormal. I like to call myself a paranormal hopeful. How do I process these things? First, I try and collect my sanity and make sure there's nothing in the environment that is playing tricks on me. If it's something that I've captured in a photo or in an audio recording, if I still have questions about it after analyzing it myself, I like to refer it to someone whose specialty is either audio or photography and try and get them to figure out how I might have captured what I captured. Without, you know, taking into consideration the paranormal. Can you tell me if I did this by user error, if this is something in the environment, which I was thrilled to learn that audio engineers can tell you a lot of times just by the frequency of the sound and the volume, the distance from the microphone, whether this was something that was near you, if it's an internal machine noise, lots of cool things like that that maybe one day I'll be proficient at myself. If they are at a loss after analyzing the data, then I like to chalk it up as something paranormal. Now, if it's something that I experienced, like I talked about with the fog, that was just a cool experience. I don't know if it was paranormal, but it was neat that it corroborated the legend that I'd heard. I have seen things move on their own. I have heard voices where no one was around me. And I guess just dealing with those things, I feel like they're more what I'm hoping to experience more often and find a reason for than something I'm trying to discount or disprove.
That's a good way to say it, that is. I mean, I think that no one wants to consider themselves children in this field. We just tend to be in places where the abnormal is normal. And that that if you're used to having the scientific method be the rule by which you live, then it becomes impossible in many cases to measure, analyze, and review the phenomena that happened. Too often, you have to rely on the judgment of people that you consider to be not crazy. They seem rational. And then if you get a chance to look afterwards. But if more than one of you, or unfortunately, if one of you, if someone, you're out by yourself and you see Robert E. Lee walk by, give you a tip his hat, smile, and keep going. I mean, am I drunk? Am I having a schizophrenic moment?
I expect to see something, and that's why I'm seeing something? There's so many things to go into factoring in that, and I don't know. I think it's worth it. Every bit of it is worth it just for the experience.
Well, one thing I will tell you is that, like any other communication, any other experience, it has to be two-way. If I speak to you and you do not listen, and you put your hands over your ears to avoid me, or you act like I'm not there, that's going to make me want to go away, or you're going to deny it. You're going to deny the fact because you're actively trying to shield yourself from it. But right. if you're open to it and you think there is that possibility that someone is here, that they are going to communicate to me in a way that is outside the norm. They're not going to send me an email. They're not going to, leave a note on my car hood. They're going to whisper in my ear because that's all they're capable of doing. I mean, you have to be open to that. And then I almost think that it's like, hey, look, she knows we're here. Let's go talk to Beth.
See, I like that outlook. They know you're paying attention.
I think they do. I mean, when I'm in investigating, I think that people, I mean, I do think that when you go into a place, more often than not, I would think almost inevitably or invariably, spirit knows you're there and that they're listening if they speak English. I don't even think they need to have the same language. I've done readings for Italian people and had it translated back from English to Italian and back and forth, and I have no idea. I can't speak Italian, but the translator could. And the spirit never left the country, this one experience. So I don't think that having to have the language in common is important as much as it is them getting in my head or me getting in their head. What was their head is now their consciousness.
Right.
So I think it's entirely possible that when you're open and you're listening and you're responding, I mean, I believe in human consciousness, and I also believe that there's still part of us, no matter how evolved we get, no matter whether we have a body or not, if I pay attention to you, you will pay attention to me, and if I ignore you, you're going to get tired of it and go away, or you're going to make four hurricane lamps all lift up at once and float around the room and crash on the floor.
That's right.
If you have that possibility. Well, I could talk about battlefields all night long, but I've got this wonderful book that you sent me, and I want to make sure we talk about some of the stories. You've been to so many places, and we've only got, we've only got a half an hour or so to talk about this. What were some of the ones that it's like, which of your children is your favorite?
Oh, so true. That's so, so similar. One of my favorite sites to investigate in the Haunted Plantations book was Shirley Plantation. And that was not so much because of the site itself. It was because I got the opportunity to meet a real paranormal celebrity. And I'm not talking like someone from television, something like that. The ghost there is quite famous. And she actually went on the road to New York City in 1974, was on the NBC Nightly News, and caused such a ruckus in New York that she was promptly sent back to Virginia. That spirit is actually a haunted painting that they have there at Shirley. And the woman in the painting is Martha Pratt. And she was just called by the family Aunt Pratt. She never lived at Shirley Plantation. As far as I know, she never even visited. I think she was living in England the entire time after the home was built until she died. And for some reason, her painting likes to rattle on the walls if it's hung in a place where she's not happy. And from what they've been able to gather over the past 200 years, is the only place that she's happy is in a first floor bedroom facing the family cemetery out the window. During the war, when McClellan's army came through from the East Coast towards Richmond, Shirley was in the direct path. And honestly, you know, McClellan's army camped at her neighbor, two doors down. So you've got thousands of men out there threatening to come through and basically destroy these southern plantations. This was sort of like the physical representation of what they were fighting in this war, was the Old South, the plantation. Sure. The family tried to rescue as many things as they could, valuable pieces of furniture, family portraits, that sort of thing, and they put them in the attic. Well, when the army came through, they were given sort of a peace offering. Hey, we'll let you stay here. We'll help treat your wounded. Just don't burn down our house. They took the family up on that offer, but the officers, the generals, and those under them were not able to stay in the house that night because the painting made so much noise in the attic, it kept everyone awake. And apparently, when it was found the next day, it had knocked down lots of things that were stored around it. It had basically rattled out from where they'd put it and was in the center of the floor. After troops moved on, they hung it somewhere different in the house. The same thing happened. It would fall off the walls all the time, keep people up at night. Eventually, they put it back in its original spot down on the first floor, and things were quiet. Well, in 74, the Rockefeller Center, I think is who it was. Pardon my memory. It's late, guys. This is past my bedtime. Rockefeller Center had an exposition of psychic artifacts, is what they called it. Basically, just haunted objects came to rest there and were put on display. And, of course, Aunt Pratt's painting was there as a centerpiece. This painting was observed shaking so violently in this museum display case that the curator had to come and remove it. They put it in a storage locker for its own safety and really for the safety of the artifacts around it. They were afraid that it was going to fall, it was going to be damaged, they were going to be held liable, maybe it was going to take out some of the things nearby. Well, it spent one night in a storage locker, and when security came to check on it the next morning, they found it outside of the locker on the floor in a storage room with its frame broken. No one has any explanation as to how it got out of a locker, a locked locker now, or how it was broken in a locked room. So they just decided maybe we should play it safe, send this thing back to where it came from. You know, everybody's had a great time seeing this on the news, hearing about it. Oh, this one's so bad it has to get sent back.
My gosh. I would love to be able... Beth, are you there? I think we have a little glitch.
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. We had just a little waffling in the in Skype somewhere. Are you... one question I would... is that... so that painting is still on display now?
Yes, the painting is hanging in its favorite spot. We'll say it, I guess, instead of her. I don't know. It's still in its favorite spot on the first floor bedroom there at Shirley. Unfortunately, they don't allow any photography in the home just because of the a lot of the historical artifacts they have there. That's their main source of income, is having folks come and see these things in person. So they don't like to let the photographs get out. There are some very low resolution photos of Aunt Pratt out there on the web, if anybody would like to see what she looks like. She looks very friendly.
You know, I have to admit, I don't know if I feel, one of the things I do is psychometry. I'm able to touch objects and tell a lot about who was there, what was there. And I would love the opportunity to go. I wonder if they would let me touch it in a respectful way.
Everyone's looking. They're pretty protective of her.
Well, don't worry. I'm not going to touch Aunt Pratt in an inappropriate way, because that's just not my style, you know?
Well, you know, just a few years ago, they had researchers from the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts come out and take a close look at the painting. She was X-rayed. And they found out that there is another painting underneath. So,
Really?
There's something to that, a link between that other painting and the haunting. Maybe it's the artist. I don't know. But the folks there at Shirley like to attribute the racket to Pratt herself.
Wow. Well, Aunt Pratt, if you're listening, yeah. I promise I would, if you permitted me to, just gently hold your hand and to see what I could pick up. We actually have a question from the chat room from our good friend Don Shy, and she was asking, if you could go on your dream investigation, where would that be?
Oh, let me think really hard.
Okay, I'll complicate it. Let's say it could be outside of Virginia.
Oh, sure. I wouldn't go very far, though, honestly. I'd love to investigate the White House. Would be fantastic. I know they have a long history of paranormal activity there. And then I think my second, can I take a second pick?
Well, okay, we're in a generous mood tonight. So actually, it's just me. Barbara's not here, but I'm sure she wouldn't mind.
I'd love to have the opportunity to investigate the Bellwitch Cave.
Oh, please tell me about that. That's a good story. That's where the Blair Witch story, is that connected
yes,
to that?
Yes, just the... probably the most fantastic and well-observed poltergeist case in the United States. I think some of the witnesses to the poltergeist activity included Andrew Jackson, lots of very other very credible people. And everything was going on in this house, from people being slapped, cut. I remember hearing one story about nuts falling from the ceiling. The woman who was the favorite of the spirit said that she wished she had walnuts, and then inside their home it rained walnuts. Yeah, really bizarre. But what the legend leans towards, and I'm not sure if you know Pat Fitzhugh, he's the author of a great book about the Bellwitch. The story of this entity really goes back to a cave. There are lots of underground caves there in this area in Tennessee, and I think even north in Kentucky. But supposedly, one of the daughters in the Bell family made contact with this entity in one of these caves. Native Americans had lots of stories about evil things in the caves around there. So, yes, my dream investigation, I guess, second to the White House, where the Secret Service is pretty scary, is going right out there to the heart of some crazy evil and just seeing what I find.
Wow. Well, that the movie, of course, it was in its day, was quite scary. And I think it would probably give me a lot to think about in another view. But so basically, you just want to go to the edge of hell, anywhere that's local.
Well, I am fascinated by poltergeist cases, and it seems like the big ones, the really well-documented historical cases, are all in the UK. So here we have one really, really big-time case here, really just a state away from me. I mean, I think that's a 8 or 10 hour drive. Mm-hmm. So it's doable. It's just finding the cave and getting up the nerve to do it.
Well, I may be able to help you if you come out to California. We were doing an investigation just this past weekend, and it was like the just the ideal setup in a way. It was, again, Indian burial grounds was where it took place. And we also, there was two young girls that lived there and their mother. So it was a single mom with two young girls. And I just walked in, and it's like, you know, there is definitely a spirit here. And it's like picking on these young girls and the single mom. And it's like, man, it feels like kind of crackling, interesting energy in this place. And they have talked about a lot of things being moved, a lot of things being shoved around. And it can be quite interesting.
Hmm.
So if you come out this way, let me know, and I'll introduce you. It's out in Thousand Oaks, California, not far from me. So an interesting place. In fact, there are people that say that these spirits walk through different townhomes, connected homes. And so, yeah, the spirit will go through from one side to the other. And it's very interesting. But let's talk. So Shirley, the... Or Aunt, what was her name again?
Aunt Pratt, yes. Aunt Pratt, Aunt Pratt, tomato, tomato, I don't know. And
Aunt Pratt, I mean, that's the first, you know, haunted object that, to that extent. Again, that sounds very Harry Potter-ish to me, but I believe you. In your investigations, in some of these, whether they're in the book or not, have you seen other shadow people, or have you seen other physical manifestations that took your breath away?
I have seen one other shadow person and then one apparition. And that was only something really that I saw in a fleeting glance, just enough to tell that it was a person, a figure, and not something else that might have been moving in the environment. The first shadow person I ever saw was in my own home, the home I started. Yeah, surprise. That's a rude awakening. And that was before I was really aware of what shadow people were. I want to say this was 2000 or 2001 when talk of shadow people was still really a little underground at that point. Mm-hmm. Had an incident, just regular night, going to bed, turned a light off, turned around to leave the room. And the light coming in my windows from outdoors was pretty bright because I do live on the edge of the city. And I could see a figure silhouetted against that light. And my first reaction was, holy cow, somebody's in my house. You know, you go on the defensive, the fight or flight really kicks in. And I took a sharp intake of breath, blinked my eyes, and then it was gone. And that was something I will not forget. It still makes my heart pound just thinking about it. Go ahead.
Well, just if it's by your home, you're not expecting it, and it happens. That's enough to take your breath away. I mean, it really is. I believe I saw a shadow person not too long ago up at Wolf Manor up in Northern California. In fact, we've got a good friend of ours, Scott Grunewald, is in the chat room tonight. So hello, Scott. But when we were up there, I mean, I wasn't expecting it. And it was in a place where they had another psychic had seen this being. And it was pretty freaky. And we also did a seance in the house. And what looked like this kind of enveloping dark cloud rolled around behind me during the seance in this house and or at the manor. And it was pretty interesting. I mean, I'm used to doing my work and not really having it recorded all the time. And to see this kind of, it almost looked like a storm cloud, you know, from like the Nature Channel, only kind of rolling through at a fairly high rate of speed.
Were you in sort of low light or in the dark, where you see this come in as darker than the rest of the darkness?
Yes, it did. In fact, we had just a couple of LEDs around. There was an infrared camera that threw out its orange light. And I'm not even, I think it was on at that time. I didn't see it, but they captured it on the... at least during the seance. But when I was standing, when I was sitting there looking in the dark, it was like in a dark room that got very, very dark against this one wall. And it was upright as if it were a human figure. So, and I was at the time listening to a spirit. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was this spirit being. It may have been more. I think there were many spirits in this one location.
Hmm.
But
do you feel the need to look over your shoulder now?
Yes. In fact, I've developed a habit. I'm with some friends that have gotten into the good habit of walking along and just turning the camera and flipping it over and shooting over their shoulder behind them. We were in, again, another place last night where we felt like, okay, there's something behind us. Jen, just take a shot. And apparently there was something there. And we actually got a big, like, a freaky light wave of it was beyond, it was in the Tate House, where the Tate Manson murders took place.
Yes.
And we were in there just for a quick hello. And up on the wall, or in the mirror, there was this odd light anomaly that none of us could explain. I mean, we know where our shadows were. We could see, and it was very low light. And then you have this almost like an overexposed kind of fountain. You've got a great photo of something like that in the back of your book on the mansions. The angelic light that was captured during your investigation at Berkeley?
Yes, that's a really bizarre sort of photo.
I don't know how someone who, it's fair to call yourself a skeptic, but how do you dismiss that? I mean,
I raked that one over the coals for almost a year before I decided to include it in the book. I'll describe the photo just quickly for people. There's something in the foreground of a photo that is very, very bright white, almost like a flash of light in itself, sort of cross-shaped, I guess. Lots of people that have seen it said that it looked like an angel, so that's where it gets the angel photo nickname. I first thought, okay, I've caught an insect, or I'm catching a reflection off of something falling from one of the trees that was overhead, until I went back and really checked the photo data and saw that I was using no flash, that my speed was up extremely high, and that in photos before and after that, I had caught insects in those photos that looked like they were just sort of frozen. I could see very clearly what the insects looked like. No one was in the area to have been shining a light, not even an LED. There was nothing reflective. I sent it to folks that know more about photography than I do and said, hey, could I have done this by accident with something on my camera? Could I have caught something in the environment? And the result of all of this digging and raking was that it was just an anomaly. It was something unknown. What made it really bizarre for me is that I shot that photo after coming out of the main house there. And you have to imagine these places were built when the utility sorts of rooms, the kitchen, the laundry, that kind of thing, were built in separate buildings for fear of fire. I walked out of the main home and sort of had this feeling, you know, when you're in a crowd and you can tell someone's watching you, you get that feeling that just the eyes on you. And I turned in the direction of the kitchen building and snapped the photo. That's where I felt this was coming from. That was the photo that had the anomaly. Nothing else that I shot that evening had anything like this. And that evening was surrounded with some really bizarre events. So that also helped to stack the odds in its favor.
Well, it looks like a beautiful country home. It looks like it's immaculately preserved, at least in the photo. And the idea that there's it's the most intense looking image pretty much in your book, in my mind. I mean, in terms of like a focal point of energy.
Oh, definitely. It sort of gets under my skin for that reason, honestly, because it's something that I, one, wasn't prepared for, and two, really had not stopped to assess in the past. You know, could these entities present themselves in such a way that they would not be overlooked?
Well, you've been out to enough places, you've written about enough places, you have photos. What is your opinion of, I think ghosts in many ways are still, there's an aspect of them that are human. We all do things for different reasons. Are there any general things that you've come to think or believe about spirit activity? I mean, what motivates them? What do you think? Where you were kind of touching on it a little bit with this idea of look at me.
I think a lot of it stems from loneliness. If you consider a spirit to be a human personality, and it's been shut off from communication for so long, maybe, you know, its grasp of the progress of time is different than ours. Maybe it has no idea what plane it's on, what's happening, or what has happened. Then they're desperate to communicate. And if we can fine-tune the means of listening, whether it be with our own brains or with these instruments that we are trying, just trial and error, to see what we can capture, maybe a lot of these questions will be answered for both sides.
Well, I agree. I think that I think they still have something to tell us, something to teach us, certainly to give us an idea of what may be ahead for us. And I want them to have that chance. I think that we do a service to them. I always think that I've got living clients in the physical and living clients in the spiritual. And that I try to be respectful for both. In fact, you know, I'm trying to make sure that when I go to a place, I'm going for the right reasons. I'm not going to exploit someone.
Oh, absolutely. I feel that anyone who is out there trying to interact with these spirits or just even capture some sort of evidence of their existence, treat them like you would real people, a living person. If you wouldn't go into your neighbor's house shouting and making demands or making threats, why would you go into a deceased person's home and do the same thing?
Have you been into places where you've gone back and investigated on numerous occasions and maybe come to understand some of these spirits better than others?
Well, we were just talking about that angelic photo from Berkeley. Berkeley is one of the sites that I've been working with. I think I'm up over 18 or 20 investigations at that place now. That's just since I began working on the Haunted Plantations book. Because they have so much activity and such a variety of activity that we're getting consistencies in the data we're retrieving. That really, to me, is sort of like the holy grail. That's what you look for, is something that you can go there and ask similar questions every time and know that the communication that you're receiving is likely coming from the same entity. You get to know each other. You start to maybe develop some trust. I know that we pick up more in our audio recordings now than we did during the first handful of investigations. The very first investigation at that site, we were met with more apprehension than anything else. We had a lot of our equipment switched off. That doesn't seem to happen anymore. It's more open and relaxed. And that site, to me, really, I think that a lot of folks that go out and investigate, you have to have a certain level of faith in what you're looking for, that it does exist, even if maybe you're unsure of that. I went through a test of faith a few years ago where I questioned if this whole spirit world was a reality or just a figment of the mass imagination. And Berkeley Plantation is what brought me back to investigating the paranormal, believing that it's there just because of the quality of data that was coming from that site.
Well, I have to tell you, too, you talk about how it's gotten to you. I mean, do you think, has it impacted your spiritual beliefs in terms of, like, I don't know if you have a particular religion or belief system?
No, actually, I guess I fall more in with agnostic than anything else. And finding this link or hearing these messages to these deceased people, which a lot of them do give indicators that that's what they are, not just some other form of energy, it's reassuring. I think that's what many of the major religions in the world do for people, is they reassure them that this is not all there is for us. This earthly existence is not the end. And I guess for me, I've reached that level of satisfaction looking for spirits.
Well, I have to tell you, in doing this work, it's changed my look on religious ideas. I mean, I was raised Catholic. We were different than I don't, you know, hold the same beliefs anymore. I just can't. It doesn't do that for me. But if we could talk about, we'll let you go soon. I know it's been a long night for you.
No problem.
But I did want to ask you about Westover. It's a beautiful place.
Okay. Anything in particular?
Well, you've got this. It's got story about it, like the bird family. It's got it's almost all the makings of a good scary story. You've got the tunnel below. You've got that connects people.
It's like Dynasty of the 1700s. Westover really was one of the first plantations my attention was drawn to, and that goes all the way back to my childhood. I had the good fortune to grow up just a few doors down of the owner of Westover. She retired as caretaker of the plantation and moved into the suburbs. And she used to tell me stories when I was 9, 10 years old about the things that she experienced in the house and how rich the history was there. Westover was the manor owned by William Byrd, who was the founder of the city of Richmond. And the legacy of the Byrd family, they are probably the most important of Virginia's first families in that they surveyed so much land, established so many cities. They laid down the border between Virginia and North Carolina. Their house and their story, though, is just tragedy after tragedy. The house was burned several times, really was just a shell. It was rebuilt. William Byrd was a very devout Protestant, and when his lovely daughter Evelyn, his really heart and soul, apple of his eye, fell head over heels in love with a Catholic boy, it was just a stab in the heart for him. He forbade her to marry him, and this sounds totally Romeo and Juliet at this point, but the historians say likely she contracted some sort of illness that was very common in the colonies at that time, but legend says she died of a broken heart. And I want to say she was only 17 years old when this happened. So obviously the whole family struck by this tragedy. And hers is one of the first spirits that's reported as haunting Westover. And that was back in the 1730s, 1740s. The neighbor next door at Berkeley. This is like one big neighborhood here on the riverfront, the James River in Virginia. We talk about these plantations. They sound like they're so isolated or so out there, but really they're just their neighbors along the same river. Anne Harrison, who lived next door at Berkeley, saw Evelyn Byrd's ghost going through the garden there. And this is a spirit that's been seen for now over 300 years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just reading about 250 years of ghostly lore and then 300 years. And I mean, the idea that there really were places with hidden tunnels and places to escape, and these beautiful paintings on the walls, and then you've got this gorgeous monument to William Byrd II, and all of
he's buried underneath, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of these homes have the family cemetery still on the property. In some instances, they still have people buried in their basements. It's all of the makings of a good haunted house.
Well, you've got them all in your backyard. How did you not become? I mean, how could you not become something of an investigator? I don't know. With all
that's, you know, people ask me all the time, how did you come into this line of work? And I just want to laugh and go, have you any idea what I'm surrounded with? It was easy. It was an easy opportunity. You can't throw a rock around here without hitting a haunted site.
Oh, or dead body buried just below the ground.
That's true.
Wow. Well, Beth, I wanted to give people a chance to find out if they want to learn more about you and Haunted Plantations of Virginia and the title of your other book. And frankly, you've written more than how many books have you written so far?
I have 4 published. I have one that's going to press here very, very soon that's not about ghosts, strangely enough. It's just about the wicked history of Richmond, everything from pirates to ladies of the night to bootleggers. And you can find out all these book titles and find out where you can purchase those at my website, which is Beth beth-brown.com.
Wow. Well, Beth-Brown. No, I won't. That's a silly thing to say. I'm sorry. I can't.
No, it's such a common name. You know, I was lucky to snag that URL when it was available.
Yeah, you must have gotten it back in 1981, I think.
You know, it's been a long time now, but I couldn't tell you when. I know it wasn't the 80s.
Well, I totally believe that. Well, I wanted to thank you so much. This book, Haunted Plantations of Virginia, and then it's Haunted Battlefields of Virginia?
Yes, Haunted Battlefields. Oh, and could I throw in, too, that something I'm really excited about with Haunted Plantations. It was recently nominated for a Library of Virginia Literary Award, and it is one of the top five finalists in the nonfiction category, and I'm crossing my fingers that come October, maybe it will take a trophy.
That would be fabulous. And by the way, if people want to hear your lovely tones on another evening on a show other than mine, how do they do that?
I am here live on Para X Saturday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, and the show on Saturday nights is The Paranormal View. I also co-host Mysterious and Unexplained with Rusty O'Neill from Down Under on Monday nights from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern.
You know, you must spend a lot of time here. You should probably get a coffee cup and just leave it right there on the shelf in Para X.
Yes, I should. I have Para X pajamas, everything.
I would think so. Well, the Paranormal View on Saturday nights, and please say hi to Henry for me.
Certainly.
I had a great time with him. Rusty, Monday night.
Nights, yeah.
Boy, it's hard to find a night. What nights are you not on the air? That might be... No, I'm kidding.
I don't know because things are mixing up. I hear a rumor that I may be on the air more often than two nights a week. We shall see.
Well, if that rumor comes true, would you be willing to come on our show and then the next show to confirm that for us?
Anytime.
Well, Beth, it's been a real pleasure. You're a very nice lady, and I love your book. It's going to give me something... It's just that you've added another big place that we've got to get to
for all the investigations. It's an easy trip. I think you can hit every site in this book in 3 days.
Wow. Well, we'll be over on Saturday then.
And I'll get the room ready for you. I'm just going to have to make sure the air conditioner holds out.
Okay. Well, that would be, I'd be willing to kick in $20 just to let it run quite a bit.
All right.
Beth, thank you again, and you have a lovely evening.
Thank you. You too. It's been a pleasure.
Mine. All ours. Good night.
Good night.
Well, Beth is a fascinating lady, and it's been a real treat having her on. And, that's one thing about doing this show. There are so many places I would like to investigate. And the more we hear, the more we know. And I have to tell you, some of the book is worth picking up, but it's well written. The photos kind of really bring you in. And it's, again, available through Schiffer Publishing. Also, who will be publishing my book when I get around to finishing this darn thing? Well, I wanted to say that I am available for if someone would like to do a reading. If someone would like me to look at a question for them, I'd be very glad to do that. If you would like to call in, the number is 818-574-8412. 818-574-8412. I'm available if someone has a question, or if you'd like to bring up a comment about something you've heard tonight. Love to discuss it. I also wanted to let you know that next week we have another guest. It's an interesting book. I'm looking forward to it. Having this lady on, Suzanne Geisman, I believe is how her name is pronounced. She's going to be the second naval commander we've had on the show. And the title of her book is The Priest and the Medium. It's about the story of a woman who was raised in the Mennonite tradition who discovers that she has psychic abilities, and that how that impacted her and her family in the small town where they grew up, and Midwest town, and what happened to them. I'm just partway in. I'm finding it to be a great read. And then she goes out and marries a guy who had intended to become a Catholic priest. He was raised in a small town, again in the Midwest, where it was a little German farming community, where the biggest thing in town was a Catholic cathedral. And it was built by early German settlers, and then he discovered that he fell in love with a lady who became a who was a men, former Mennonite and full-time psychic. So there's this great story. It's told by an interesting person. And I hope that you'll join us next week. But in the interim, if you do have, if you'd like me to do a reading for you, the number is 818-574-8412. 818-574-8412. I know it's late in some parts of the country, and the eastern part, I guess we would describe it. But it's been, I really enjoyed having Beth on. It also, you know, she gives me some pointers about how to get a book done. I mean, she's really worked it hard, and hats off to her. And I had to tell you, I don't know if it's a southern accent, but she has a great voice and a very interesting lady. I wanted to also do a shout out to my lovely wife, Barbara. She's worked her rear end off this week, and she has a kind of coming down with something. And so that's why you're just stuck with listening to me tonight. I much prefer being able to have her on the air. But I just wanted to say, I guess we do have, so would you have a question from the chat room? Do I have any feelings on the oil spill and the storm heading towards it this weekend? I do think that it's going to, there's going to be, I'm hearing that some things, some of the gear that they have in place is going to be torn away a little bit. I do think that there's going to be some seepage, but nothing significant. I think they've got it under control. I feel like that this, I feel like that there's one more big glitch in their repair of this. I do feel like that there's going to, they need to get this other relief tunnel working, or this relief well going, in order to relieve the pressure. But I think that this gets done, and but I do feel that clearly in the Gulf they're going to be feeling this for many years to come. So say if you want to say a prayer, you want to surround the Gulf close and white light of love and divine protection, I urge you to do it. They're going to need it. Say a prayer for all of the people too who are out there working so hard to undo this terrible disaster that is has taken the lives of people, sea mammals, sea life, lots of fish, and also robbed many people from their way of life. I mean, it was an accident. It was, and we'll let other people decide what the cause, whether it was neglect or greed or an innocent accident. I can't say. I have my own opinions, but let's just say that hopefully the some sort of truth will come out. I don't know if we'll ever get the entire truth. And then in terms of what's happening in North Korea, I think that, I hate to say it, but I do think that there could be room for a conflict up there. They've already had a South Korean naval vessel attacked. I don't think that the North is ready for a full-scale war. I don't think that they're willing to do that, but I think that they are willing to continue escalating things in order. This is all about leverage in negotiating. I don't think they want a full-fledged war, but I do think that they want to turn up the heat in order to get what they want. So I think it's very much a cat-and-mouse game. While I think that Kim, I think his name, I can't remember the premier of North Korea. I don't think he's crazy enough to invite a full-scale war, because it's not something that he would win. So I don't think that's going to come, but I do expect to see more lives lost and a ratcheting up of it, because I tend to think that they're running out of time up there. And so in order to get the most favorable deal that he can, this leader of North Korea is going to be belligerent and press as much as he can in order to get what he wants before this state of his collapses. That's my impression. And as far as Iran, I'm not seeing any, I don't see us going in there at all. I don't see us doing that, although I do see us doing what we can to turn up the heat on them. I don't think that I'm not seeing an attack there on Israel or anybody else as being imminent. Again, these countries do better getting what they want by keeping the fire from going to a complete all-out war. I mean, they would lose, but they do get a lot if they're willing to be problematic. Kim Jong-il, thank you, Firefly. His time, I just see that they are going to have, they can only keep the lid on North Korea for so long before it just comes apart. I do feel I think that within the next few years, we do see a reunification of North and South Korea. I think that China will be amenable to this because they don't want to have to be burdened by having to take care of this client state that is not doing very well for themselves. They're a burden on China, and I don't see China objecting to. I see this as changing and becoming a unified state. And I think that's going to come well within our lifetime and possibly within the next 3 to 4 years. So that's something I'm expecting. In terms of anything else, one of the predictions, I felt that I think we're going to see the economy continue to slowly come back. I mean, a lot of people are saying this. Everyone has an opinion. I have to tell you, I feel like we're going to see more unrest and problems in real estate. I know in our own Southern California region, and it's not unusual, any place that has seen a lot of speculation in the past, I think that house prices continue to fall. I think that we are going to, it's going to be, within 2 years, the economy is still going to be the issue that sways the election. And I think that's something that is going to, it's not going to go away soon. I do see it gradually getting better, and I think it'll improve nationally to, I'm hearing like 8.9%, 9% in certain parts of the country. That'll be a great improvement, but it's still a deplorable figure that I think we'll have to live with for a while. So I guess if we don't have anybody else that would like to call in tonight, we might actually say goodnight a little bit early. So I wanted to thank Beth. I wanted to thank all of our listeners, and I appreciate everyone being with us tonight. It's been a heck of a week for me, too. For some reason, everything that I had to do all happened at once this week. So I wanted to say thank you all for listening. We've got our listeners in the UK and the US. Thank you for listening. It's a real treat to be able to bring interesting authors like Beth to you. And she's a great personality and a really interesting investigator and an accomplished author. I highly suggest you read her book. So until next week, we'll be back with the story of the priest and the medium and how they came together. So until then, have a positively psychic week. Thank you for being with us. Oh, let's see. And I guess we have one more question. If no one, let's see. Am I talking about the book is actually called The Psychic and the Medium, and it is about a Mennonite woman, and Suzanne Geisman, G-I-E, I believe it is, S-S-M-A-N. Look her up. I think you'll find her quite interesting. The Priest and the Medium, G-I-E-S-S-E-M-A-N. So until next week, have a positively psychic week, and thank you for joining us. Good night.
This has been a Para-X production, sponsored by CBS Radio. We'll see you next week on Positively Psychic.
Listening at home, at work, or anywhere. Thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal. Para-X.
Hello, this is Barbara Nelson from Positively Psychic with your host, psychic medium Mark Christopher Nelson on Para-X Radio. Mark and I would like to thank all of our listeners for their support of our web radio show, Positively Psychic. With your support, we can keep bringing you the best web radio programming and Podomatic and iTunes downloading. So keep listening, and we'll keep bringing you great paranormal programs from Positively Psychic. With guests like John Searle, Patrick Burns, Marla Gibson, Allison Dubois, and Chris Fleming. So tune in each week, every Thursday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 Eastern, on Para-X Radio, the leader in paranormal web radio. Thanks again for your support, and we'll see you here next time on Positively Psychic.
Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.